ago come to about her middle 30s. She had drugs. He had talked her selling everything she, and he was on orders for overseas, and they flew to New York, and he spent the night in for a career. He was going to go looking somewhere else. He was going to go AWOL and then became a deserter. And he had a lot of debts, so he left her to live with him about 20. And he was with her, the rich woman, the woman who came. She had no home. For her, it was a very, very. Had walked all over. Need to be with. No. To do. And what they. Hey, there's no way you ought to stay with a guy like that. I mean, that was just. To her, you would think she's borderline on the. Stay with him, to go down and to take so much, to have him totally wreck her life, wreck his own life, and then still feel a loyalty when he was living with another woman, feel a loyalty to him. I've learned a few things very slowly, and I've learned that basically. In life, we are almost all equally intelligent as far as common sense goes. And if something is very obvious to me, it's very obvious to that woman. And if she's staying with him, she's got to be staying with him for a reason. And if I were to tell her to leave, I'm not helping her. As a matter of fact, I probably am going to make things worse for her. Because if she could leave this guy, she'd have left him long before this. She had left him two desertions before this. Desertions of her, not of the military. Somehow she's got an emotional need to be with that man, and it's just not simple for her to walk out. I'll also say something else. If you just treat the symptom and not the cause, should she for some reason, and I'll tell you in a moment how you can, when there's an emergency, talk to people like this. There is a language that can be used. But should she for some reason leave him, almost inevitably, she will hook up with an echo of that man within 2 to 3 years. And just let me give an example. In case, for those of you who are here and don't know me, I'm a sober alcoholic. I've been sober now for 17 years, and I spend much of my life dealing with alcoholics and drug addicts, people who are trying to stay sober. And I know them from coast to coast, and I have hundreds of them, thousands of them literally, that I've met who are friends of mine, and I have a lot of experiences I could share. There's a rather fascinating thing. A normal, healthy person cannot stay married to an alcoholic and watch her or him destroy themselves. You just can't do it. Watch this person literally lose everything and die. A healthy person must leave pain like that. But there's a certain kind of personality, and it's the kind of personality we're talking about, that will often stay in an alcoholic marriage, being beaten up, having the kids molested, being sugar daddy to him because he keeps losing his job. They'll stay in the marriage. Sometimes they will reach a breaking point and they'll leave the alcoholic. Almost inevitably, the next person they marry is an alcoholic. I know women who have gone through four marriages like this, one alcoholic after another, after another, after another. There's something in the woman that if you don't go in, look at the cause and treat the cause, makes it almost inevitable that they're going to be back in a relationship. So if you just treat the symptom first and you don't treat the cause, the problem's going to break out again. It's like just taking an aspirin for a pain that's caused by some real problem in the body. The aspirin doesn't solve the problem at all, and when the aspirin's over, that pain is right back and it's growing worse. If I were to tell this woman to leave the man and that's all, I am not treating her problem. The problem is, why have you stayed with him? Why are you sitting here? And when this man has stomped all over you and given you, listening to you, nothing in your life, why do you feel a great emotional need to stay with him? Switching to another one. I'm changing facts, incidentally. If you were to meet some of these people, you wouldn't know them, because there's enough facts being altered one way or another that you just can't tell. So I'll just pick a, I got to pick sort of a profession, and pick, since David is here, I'll pick realtors. I have a drug addict that I'm a sponsor of, who's a very successful realtor, we'll make her. She's been off drugs now for 14 years. She's successful enough that in 1 year, she sold $4 million worth of real estate, would be the equivalent in the field she's in. So this is not an unsuccessful woman. She's a husband of, she's a mother of three children. Her husband is a drinking alcoholic, and he admits it. He's admitted it to me. He has been physically violent with her. He is constantly emotionally violent with her, and he has abused all three of the children. She has been carrying the family. She has been earning the income. The children are away from the home now. He constantly dumps garbage on her, and she buys every bit of it. Even though she's drug-free and alcohol-free for well over 10 years, even though she's tremendously successful, state-recognized as a success in her field with plaques for how much she has sold, even though she's carrying the family, even though she's clean and he's a drinking alcoholic, he makes her feel guilt and responsible for everything that's going wrong in his life. Now, that just doesn't happen normally to a normal person. I'm going to switch again, because I can share so much of this because I've got the personality. I often don't like talking about this because it's the success part. I have 11 years of college, nearly all straight A's, Phi Beta Kappa from Penn State, two bachelor's degrees. I believe that I have had a certain recognition in life. I'll go back about 6 years. I've flown across much of the country giving retreats and talks. And I would be with Father Levin in Edmond and just tell him how I felt absolutely worthless. And he couldn't believe it. Because looking at the externals of my life, it looked like everything was a tremendous success. But in here, I felt like an absolute failure. And at times, one time in my life, I got angry because a woman who came to talk as a result of that talk died sober. About 9 months later, she died very quickly of cancer. This will be much. I have a nephew. Probably have had one child. Age of two, was sitting like over here. There in one room, my mother and my sister and I were sitting here talking, and he was. But walking across the carpet, my mother would tell him don't, and he would sit. To yell at him again. And then about 10 minutes later, my mother, who doesn't have much patience, slapped him. And he'd cry. And 3 minutes later, he's going to the television. Now, this kid is learning early a pattern of living that I'm going to label, and a lot of other people do, getting negative strokes. He's getting attention by getting into trouble. And he's going to continue to do it. And only really through this have I come to understand why a lot of people do negative strokes and why normal people sometimes will do absolutely stupid things and get into a pattern and a habit of doing it. All of it deals with the term that I'm going to share with you. If you weren't around, in my opinion, it is absolutely the most studied field of psychiatry in the United States in the last 3 years. from what I've heard and can tell from others, it probably equals all the studies done on it in the last 3 years, studies done on everything else. Up on the table here, a variety of superb books. The one that probably first broke through is one called Codependent No More. And then probably the single best thing, and if you're into reading and you want to help a lot of problems with your family, this is written by a man named John Bradshaw, Healing the Shame That Binds You. I'm only through it, but friends of mine have listened to it, just come out with the highest praises for it. I told you that if I just treat the symptom, I don't help the person. More than that, I can cause a problem. If I were to tell that woman, leave him, I'm putting her under guilt. She'd have left him if she could. And the fact that she isn't doing that means for some emotional reason she can't. And if she does, she may fall apart emotionally. One of my close priest friends always makes my stomach kind of get tight, because if he has a woman married to an abusive alcoholic come to see him, he always gives the woman the same advice. The next time the man is drunk, tie him up with the sheets in bed and beat the crap out of him. Now, that's good advice, but that woman is absolutely incapable of doing that. If she could have done it, she'd have done it a long time ago. And to tell her to do it tells her something up here that makes sense and something down here that she can't do at all. And so it puts a burden on her, and she leaves feeling more guilt actually inside than she came. Now, the amazing thing, all these problems I've talked about, mine, the successful realtor, the woman who was deserted, all of these problems, traditional psychiatry is absolutely helpless in dealing with. And in order to do this, for you to see this, first, what I'll tell you is, because traditional psychiatry digs into the past. If I'm here doing something dumb, and I go to a true friend, he's going to take me back into my past to find out why I did it. And a friend of mine in Oklahoma City uses this example, and it's so priceless that I can't come up with anything better. Supposing today I'm sitting here feeling an inner lack of worth because when I was 72 days old, my mother left a wet diaper on 20 minutes too long and I felt rejected and abandoned. Supposing that was the actual first domino that caused all my problems. And I go to a tremendous shrink and he slowly, through therapy, frees me to go back and we discover that. What's changed? I'm still the same. I can't go back today and change the diaper earlier, I still feel a sense of worthlessness. Traditional psychiatry deals with past causes. And that doesn't help at all with the whole area of codependency, with one entire area of present-day problems. Not at all. Now, that's kind of shocking to us. Because, you see, we have been taught to try to find out why. I've got a cousin that's almost a twin. Two sisters marry two brothers, and our thought patterns are the same. We talk as fast. When we're together, we finish each other's sentences. You never get to finish a thought because I know what she's going to say and she knows what I'm going to say. We're born like a few months apart, went through school together. And when she started coming up, and I was slowly showing her that she was what I call almost, she had almost terminal codependency. She's a millionaire. Her husband has had a mistress for 20 years. Every time the husband sleeps with the mistress, before he gets home, the mistress calls and won't talk, just keeps dialing her and picking up the phone, and there's silence on the phone. The husband's bought the mistress a home, set her up a business and a brand new Cadillac. And my cousin knows all this, and she's been staying, walking with all this pain. And she finally began to see the reason she's doing it is she doesn't feel a real sense of inner worth here. Every time when we would start talking about it, her first question is, why? Why am I like this? And my response first is, that won't help us at all. See, sometimes, and I'll show you in a moment where learning the cause is part of the solution. Sometimes it is, but very often it isn't. I had smoked 3 packs of cigarettes till about 12 years ago. Supposing during my smoking, I had smoked enough that I came down with lung cancer. And medical science could really prove to me I have lung cancer today because of smoking. Learning the cause has nothing to do with the cure. It can keep me from bringing, I'm aggravating it, but it has nothing to do with the cure. The cure for lung cancer doesn't come from stopping smoking. I'll go right on and die. The cure from lung cancer comes from surgery, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, one of the new things. The cure and the cause are separate. And when you get into this area, you have to understand that. Because tonight, when we're sharing, I'm going to share things that probably over two-thirds of you are going to walk out, maybe if you just think that you're responsible, feeling guilt for how you raised your kids. Don't worry about that. My answer to that, if you belong to any Christian church, a loving God from all eternity foresaw who you would be and who you are and the kind of parent you would be. And he picked you to be the best parents in his plan for the children you have had. He wants them then to use the opportunities he presents them to grow. So don't walk out with guilt if you hear things that make you feel like you weren't a perfect parent, because that's going to come up as part of the causes that we'll be looking at in a moment. What I need to know with codependency and a lot of other problems is not what caused it, but what can I do about it today? I was in a meeting with drug addicts yesterday, and this was one of the points we were talking about. My parents may have caused my disease, but I'm responsible for its cure. They may be at fault, but it's my life. It could be their error yesterday, but it's my today, and it's my life in the today. And it's sad if somebody sees this and they ruin their today simply by blaming their parents for what they did yesterday. And that happens. That's happening a lot right now in the first days of looking at all this. Now, I told you first, sometimes when you deal with a codependent, there's a need for an immediate help. You got to treat the symptom for a reason. And I'll give you the classic example. Codependents are people with no inner self-worth. Let's not make a mystery about it. I'll explain that in a moment. If a person has no feeling of self-worth, they can't make any demands. Codependents will ask for nothing in divorces. Probably the absolute worst I have ever seen was a woman who had 5 children, none of them in school yet, divorced her alcoholic husband and took nothing. And I mean nothing. No furniture, not the house, not the car, no child support, no alimony. Because she didn't feel good enough. Since that time, I've been part of talking to, well, I'll call them Al-Anons, to 30, 40, 50 Al-Anons who are going to put themselves in exactly the same situation. Up here, they'll have a reason. The real reason's down here. I feel no worth, and if I have no value, how can I ask for anything? I have no right to ask for anything. I don't belong in the world. And if I don't belong in the world and I ask for something, you're really going to throw me out. You may tolerate me if I don't make a wave, but I'm not allowed to make a wave. Now, I'm putting words on feelings. They don't come this clear. They won't have the thoughts that clear, but looking at someone else's life, I can reason this. When there's an emergency, and in these cases, in faced with a divorce, there is an emergency to need to talk to the person. There is one language that once I learned it, never fails on a short run. It is not a solution, but never fails on a short run talking to a codependent. They operate from guilt, from shame. That's the language you use. You make them feel guiltier for not taking care of themselves than they would if they do. Let me give you the example. I've told you that the woman with the 5 kids, she was in her divorce and I couldn't do anything. She's the one that brought me face to face with that. Since then, every one of the others who have come to me, I've been able to help. They've gotten good divorce terms. Because when I sit down, they tell me they're going to leave with nothing. Here's what I tell them. If you walk out of this marriage taking nothing, first, if they have kids, you are robbing from your children and you have no right to do that. Secondly, and this is with all of them, you become an accessory to the next woman he hurts the way he's hurt you, because you are teaching him he can walk in and out of a life without having to pay anything. And you're setting him up for the next woman he hurts, and you better carry that guilt. And I hit him with the guilt. And every one of them go to a lawyer. And once you get them to move, then they get vicious. You know, they go for lawyers that go for the jugular. And the poor guy, you know, they get the right lawyer that helps. But see, they need that. Now, I'm not touching the problem. But if there is a need right now to deal with a now problem, the only real language that a codependent truly hears in the sickness, in the problem, and I'm using sickness not in a bad way, The only real problem they will, the language they're going to hear is the language of guilt. It's the language. What solves the problem? Traditional psychiatry doesn't. I'm going to take you through traditional psychiatry for me to tell you what Freud gave and then what we've started discovering in the last few years. I grew up with a lot of, like a lot of people, laughing at Freud. It all sounded kooky. I mean, the fact that our lives are run by the unconscious, that seemed weird. And yet, the door that Freud walked through to understand everything he came up with is something that almost every one of us here have heard about. We may have seen it on television. We may have been at parties where it was done. It's called post-hypnotic suggestion. If I were a hypnotist and, Gayleen were a good subject. Not everybody can be hypnotized. Gayleen was capable of being hypnotized. And she went into hypnotic state. This is what I could say. Gayleen, in about 2 minutes, I'm going to count to three and snap my fingers. At that time, you will wake up. You will feel very good. You will remember nothing that happened while you were hypnotized. In about five minutes, I'm going to use the word irrelevant and step sideways. When I do, you'll walk over and open the door. And then I say, one, two, three, snap my fingers. She wakes up. She feels wonderful. She's sitting there feeling great. I talk, use a sentence. I say, well, you know, there's an awful lot of things in psychiatry today that are pretty irrelevant. And all of a sudden, she may not get up to open the door, but her good mood is gone forever if she doesn't. She's sitting there with a tremendous urge to open the door. Probably she'll open it. She will get up from the chair, walk through the row of people, walk over and open the door. We ask her, why'd she do it? She will come up with a reason. We have to. I was hot, was stuffy, I felt faint. I thought I heard a noise outside. Something. The important thing, the true reason for her action is outside the area of her conscious, of her awareness. And that's all Freud began with. Something that I'm not aware of can be the real reason for why I act the way I do. Everybody believes that. Really. I don't know if everybody believes it, but everybody can watch it demonstrated. You can prove it with hypnosis. Now, what happens is, as we grow up, we are faced with feelings, thoughts, drives that are too unpleasant to hold in our mind for some reason. We've been told not to have this experience, and so we push it down. We push it out of our conscious. We refuse, our mind refuses to be aware of it, but that doesn't mean it stops influencing our lives. We dealt with the area of sex, and that's because in Western society, and that's where all of us come from, sex, for religious reasons, out of the way our Christianity has developed, and probably to a large extent because the Catholic Church has had a celibate priesthood, often with priests over and nuns over thinking about sex more than it's in the Bible. Whatever reason, sex has become very emotionally tinged in our society, and so a lot of things dealing with sex are pushed down. That doesn't mean they lose their power. It means I can't be aware that it's here. Anger can be pushed down too. So I've got a force here that I can't see, but it stays active on my life. And I'm going to give you a variety of ways that I can deal with this, just to give you some examples. One is something called these are defense mechanisms. It's called, forgot the term before and I got it here, reaction formation. It's a fascinating thing. What it is I have a strong urge. I'm not allowed to have this. So what happens, I go the exact opposite direction. I have a strong urge to be sexual. My mother had tremendous hang-up on her child in the area of sex, and she passed them on to us. Hang-ups here. So my sexual feelings, to a large part, will be repressed. Now, what I could do if my drives were very strong is, rather than become sort of a stud, I become a Puritan. And I'm one of the strictest people in the area of sex, denouncing it anywhere and everywhere and campaigning against it. There was a movie that most of you are too young to have seen, but I saw. Sadie Thompson, I think with Rita Hayworth or somebody, She was a very loose woman in the South Pacific. And all through the there is a minister who is denouncing her until he propositions her. And it wasn't phony, the denouncing. What it is that was reaction formation. And all of a sudden, his drives got so strong that they broke through and he propositions her. And when she turned him down, he commits suicide because he couldn't live then with the rejection. That's a perfect instance of reaction formation. There aren't any here. I was afraid of this when I talked to the teachers in here too. Sometimes there are some women and some men. We have a priest. I don't think any of you have ever met him. We have a priest. We call him Flash Gordon. Other priests, because his hair is never, ever out of place. Everything must be exactly right. In his case, and in the case of some other people like this, actually in the unconscious, he has a tremendous desire to just go loose with no control at all. And he's taken a desire that was pushed down and using it the opposite way. So that's one way I can handle a force I'm not allowed to handle. Another way, one that I have, and it's probably the single most common defense mechanism that all of us use, is something called projection. I have a feeling, and I project it out on you because I'm not allowed to have the feeling. Something you do, so I go out with an answer, why don't you like me? And people wondering, how do you know I don't like you? What have I done? If I haven't done anything, then the feeling's in you. Where's the feeling? Where's this feeling of dislike in you? How do you know it's in me unless I've told you? And if I haven't told you, then it's in you and throwing it on me. I will give you, and this has to be done, it cannot be done nicely. I'll give you one of the most extraordinary examples of this. Buried. One of the more interesting people I've met in my life was a woman who was seduced in therapy by three different Protestant ministers. And I'm not putting the ministers down because it could have happened to anybody. Now, I have learned a basic rule of life. Once, I don't know. Twice, once, if something happens to me, once, it might be you, it might be me. Twice, I put a question mark. Three times, it's my fault. From the third time on. No doubt about that. If I'm in a pattern, I'll take an extreme because I deal with it so much. If a wife is beaten by her drunken husband, first time, I'll blame him. Second time, I don't know. From the third time on, she's to blame. She is setting him up. She knows the buttons to push. He comes home and she goes, and the whole world gives her pity because her drunken bum of a husband beat her up. But she knocked off the first domino that day that does it. And you may not like to hear this, but this is solidly valid. Anyway, this woman, in talking to me, as I shared, there is no nice way to say this, do this, was sitting in my living room in a big chair like this. Okay? I point, now there's something called body talk. I've learned very what a person's body says. I saw it last night at this meeting of drug addicts. There was a gal who did not like the person she was next to. And so what she did is she cut him off with her body. Now, I'm up here, so you all have to turn this way. But like body talk, if you're sitting at a straight table and someone sits like this, my body talk is I want nothing to do with you. I am rejecting you. I saw that happen once to a woman that I cut off a friend, and we did some digging, and I found out that she couldn't really stand that woman at all, and the body talk showed it. This woman's body talk is saying, hey, here I am, come on, get me. On the surface, she was very prudish. I pointed it out to her, and I mean this is true, she was shocked as anything. There's no games being played here, this was real to her. She was flabbergasted. Within 2 minutes, she got in the chair. She was not treated poorly by the chest fairy in life, okay? I got to tell you this for the next thing to make sense. She got up from the chair and she said, oh, my back hurts. I mean, the one time you could say I read, you couldn't even, that first one was so obvious. The first, she wouldn't see it. The second one, but consciously, all of her drives, she's not allowed to have sex drives, she shoves them down. People are suggesting her, she's not active, but it's affecting her life. Because, as I try to tell people I sponsor, you know, if a gal's walking around with the buttons open all the way down here and she's advertising herself, people are going to listen to what she's saying. You know, if you're acting like a pig, you're not going to have a prince date you. I mean, there aren't a lot of women who do kiss frogs. There really aren't. Unless they're true codependents. The codependent will do it for a different reason. But not in a very healthy way. Okay. So Freudian psychiatry is based then on things being shoved down. I'm not aware of them. And yet they do somehow or other affect how I'm acting and how my life goes. Now in this kind of therapy, what you do want to do is you want to go back into the past and go through dreams, go through hypnosis, go through talking and little word associations, and you get the person to see, bing, 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 bing. Hey, you do have a lot of anger there. There's an awful lot of anger buried in there. You are mad. You're mad, and it's okay. And you let the person bring the feeling up that's been buried. And that's the doorway to health. In repression, going back and finding out the cause starts coming up with the cure. If I find out my problems are likes me, are caused by my mother not allowing me to feel anger. And so I repress anger, and I've got in here, and I slap it on you because I'm not allowed to be mad at you, but I can feel then when I'm upset with you. Now see, I can't deal with a good relationship like that. If you're all mad at me, and you're not really, how can I make a good relationship? I have to really take responsibility for what I'm doing. See, I've got anger. It's okay to be angry. It's a human feeling. Anger itself is not the sin. Acting on anger is the sin. It's what hurts, what harms. So the anger itself is okay. When I see that and I allow myself to feel the anger, then I will create, I can relate in a healthy way. And then I can start taking responsibility for the relationship. And if you're doing something that upsets me, I can say, you know, that's not acceptable to me. If you do that, I'm not going to be around. When I had no rights, when it was all being repressed. I like some of the more interesting cases in psychiatry. I'm going to tell you one that was absolutely fascinating. A man made an association between his wife. He identified his wife with his mother. He was impotent. He couldn't have intercourse with her at all. But he had normal sex drives, so he went out and got a mistress. Well, he couldn't have... But he had tremendous intercourse with his mistress, so whose fault must it be? It's got to be the wife's fault. So he divorced the wife and married the mistress, which instantly made her the wife, and almost instantly the Madonna complex came up. That's what they call this in psychiatry. Then his mother, and within like a month or two, he couldn't have intercourse. But he had normal sex drives, so he got another mistress. He went through 5 marriages like this before he began slowly to see the problem, work through the problem, go into therapy, and identify what his problem was. So in Freudian psychiatry, going back here is the solution with the problem. Incidentally, so you know, we will break in about another 30 minutes, and then for about like 10 minutes, let people go to the restroom, and then pick up however we have to. Have to leave, you know, just feel comfortable to walk. Sex is at the core, as I told you, of Freudian psychiatry. We don't know about this. Sometimes we laugh at it. One of the interesting things about Freudian psychiatry is that it identifies anything long and straight that is used a lot as a symbol of the male sex organ, and anything round as a symbol of the female sex organ. And when I heard that at Penn State in psychiatry course, I just thought that was absolute nonsense. I had one little fascinating scene happen in a mental hospital where I was taking a course with a patient that told me there is a truth to Freudian symbolism. I'm going to repeat it. We had a woman and I'll help you with this so that in case you know anybody that you won't worry too much. We had a woman who in her mid-30s had her first child and went totally psychotic. She thought she was Eve, Adam's wife, and took off all of her clothes and went for a walk around the garden, which was the block. The neighbors called the police, and she was in the hospital. They frown upon that in normal society. Incidentally, because of all those facts, after the birth, the age when the first popped on, no earlier symptoms, her prognosis was superb. Chances were almost certain she'd be out of the hospital and never have to go back about like 2 to 3 months of just getting her on some right medication. But I got to talk to her, and she had very many hang-ups with the area of urine. The day after she came in, when she was totally sedated, and the real, like all this stuff could bubble up. The sedatives will allow the unconscious to come through often. And she starts talking to me, and she says, I'm Eve, real slow. I'm Adam's wife. I'm going to skip a moment and tell you, like, we were supposed to do what they call non-objective therapy. Everywhere. And like at one point, she gave me a good insight. She said, you know, she's talking along and she looked at me and she says, would you have intercourse with me? And I asked, why do you want to have intercourse with me? And her answer was astounding. And it will tie up totally with codependency. So I can prove myself to you. She had no inner worth, felt that any value she could have that would come from being sexual, in the presence of someone knew she felt nothing but she could sex that could ever give her any kind of value. If she were sexually useful, she'd have a value. But I talked about the sexual symbolism. Listen to this next thing. She says, I'm Eve, Adam's wife. I'm the one who ate the banana in the garden. Now, nowhere, anywhere, ever have I seen a hint in any literature of it being... Incidentally, biblically, the fruit is not identified. It's just the fruit. We've made it an apple. But she told me like she had a tremendous hang-up with this, the male sex organ and everything going with it, and it just comes out. So there are a lot of things that are repressed. And Freud opened the door to that. It helped us see that so many of the problems we have deal with areas outside our mind. Now, there's one big problem with Freudian psychiatry. It doesn't work for most people. Because they've just really started coming into this now, because most people, big problem is not with repression, it's with what I'm going to deal with, codependency. And codependency can start, you can just, several different terms you could use. I've got a real nice one that a friend of mine gave me just about a month ago. You could call it, this is caused by repression. Codependency is caused by deprivation. I'm deprived of something. I'm going to jump ahead and give you the biblical background, how you can find something very, very beautiful for this. Abraham had a son, Isaac. Isaac had two children. Now, the Bible thinks in very real terms, and it's teaching things in a nice way. A blessing, it's like a goodness in me. And if I give you the blessing, it comes out of me. It's a real thing. I give it to you, and you have it, and you are blessed. It's going to happen. It's going to unravel, but you have the blessing. Isaac has a blessing to give, and it is normally given to the eldest child. And as you know the story, Jacob cheats Esau. Jacob comes, gets the blessing. Esau then comes and says, I need your blessing. And Isaac said, I gave it. And Esau realizes and he says, I need your blessing. I need to be blessed. And Jacob has to say, I've emptied myself of it. I don't have anything to give. And Esau pleads for something. And Jacob just says wishy-washy words. And Esau then leaves going through life without the blessing. This will not appear in any psychiatry book. But it's about the neatest clue to the quickest way for me to ask you if you're codependent or not. When you climb inside yourself, when you were in junior high, senior high, in your 20s and your 30s, right now, have you ever truly inside received the blessing? Do you know, do you feel that you're a blessed child? There are people who truly do. You can only get it if your parents had it. You cannot get it, well, you could not get it as a child if they did not have it. They can't give what they don't have. We'll talk about that in a moment. But so when I'm talking about codependency, a codependent is a person who inside does not feel blessed. Putting it in different terms, when I said deprived, there are people who truly feel a sense of self-worth. Codependents grow up for whatever reason, and the cause is not important first. They grow up not experiencing that sense of self-worth. That leads to the definition of the term. People were talking about it, codependent, joking about it in a sense. Here is the root of the word, because some people mock the term. It means like, I'm an alcoholic and you suffer from it. This is my co-alcoholic. And that's actually where it began. But the term codependent describes anyone who lacks an inner sense of worth and is dependent on something outside themselves to get it. Anything else. Anything is from the Greek dependent on something else. I don't have it myself. It's not that I'm sharing somebody else's dependency. Rather than within, to get my inner sense of value. This is, as I shared with you, the real discovery that we've been making in the whole area of the human mind in the last about 10 years. The studies are just exploding right now. The early studies dealt with families of alcoholics. Because there was money in this area, people wondered. The question I posed to you, why would a woman marry four alcoholics in a row? Why would a woman stand by and watch her husband abuse her three children when she was so successful? Why would she stay in the marriage? Why would she support him? Why would she watch him die? Why would she take physical and mental abuse? Why? Why does a person do this? And they started asking those questions. And then all of a sudden they started looking at other people. And they began to come up with this, hey, this is the root problem. This is the root question. People guess that over, and this is almost every big psychiatrist guess, that over 60% of the American people are codependent. So more than half of us in the room. Inside, as we grow up, don't feel this sense of self-worth. So don't feel guilty. I'm not making you anything. You know, I'm helping you understand yourself if within you have lacked this feeling. And so you can feel comfortable. I can tell you I lived this way for 35 years and I can tell you the exact day it ended. I know the precise day I got the blessing. It was, I didn't think anybody ever had it, see. Because all you have is your own experience. And if you haven't had it, it makes it even worse when you look at everybody else. If you stood here, if you stood where I'm standing or sat here and looked out at all of us, and you're codependent, I absolutely guarantee you will feel, now catch my feelings, you will feel you look and that's deadly in life. You're comparing your feelings, your insides, where you don't feel worth, to our outsides, where we don't show you that we're, You know, just look across the table a moment. Everybody look at someone else. Does anybody else here feel like they, you know, nobody looks like they don't have any worth? You know, I'm saying over half of us lack it, and if you went around, how could we spoil? You can't. You know, you look around at the person across, you can't. She doesn't feel like, she looks like she is worth. She looks like she is worth. Y'all look like you have worth. I'm the only one that feels worthless. And that's how codependence in the early days, in the early years. If over half of America lacks the blessing, lacks this deprived of being affirmed. When I said it's a deprivation neurosis, I'm going to jump a moment. If you deal a lot with youngsters and you really want to walk through some heavy stuff, this is one of the most tremendous series of tapes, I know. This helped open my eyes to so much. It's a woman called Permission, workshop called Permission to be Precious by a gal named Pia Melody. I'll loan the tape. Hers are copyrighted. I've got about five of hers. This will upset you. Her thesis, and I'm stealing her idea as the basis for the retreat I'm giving next weekend in St. Louis. Once you believe there's a God, a loving God, intended you and every other child, intended you to be precious, and precious in every major area of your life, not just in soul. You are intended to know you are precious physically, emotionally, that your feelings are precious. Anger and fear are not ugly, they're not dirty, they're precious. They're instincts of life to protect life. Let me quickly show that, because see, a lot of Christians can confuse what Jesus said. If you hate your brother in your mind, you're already committing sin. And lust in this sense. Feelings in this area aren't the error. If I am hating you and dwelling on that and resenting you, not the feeling of anger, but I go into the resentment, that's destroying my peace. And Jesus wants me to know peace. I can't know peace in my heart and hate you in my mind. Hating you in my mind is very little different from hating you in the world as far as destroying my peace. And see, that's advice to me. Don't ruin your peace hating someone else. But you take any animal, we talked about the lamb. The lamb must be one then. Take any animal with no fear and no anger, and it can't make it in nature unless it's an elephant. You know, they might. But nothing else can. Anger removes you from a threat. No. It's fear. Fear removes you from the threat and preserves your life. Anger goes outward from you to remove the threat and preserve your life. They're instincts of life to preserve life. We're supposed to be emotionally precious. Supposed to be physically precious. When I was 35 years old, I couldn't picture my face. I think I've shown some of the parishioners. If I haven't, well, I've got to be sure to do this much. Picture of me that I carry around now the last 3 or 4 years with my big ears. My ears stood out just like this. And they're about that big. People have heard me share this for 10, 12 years. It's part of the talk I give with alcoholics because it affected me so much. And after hearing this, people thought, oh, I exaggerated. They stuck out a little bit. The first person I showed the picture to, and it's interesting, their remarks were exactly the same. When did you have plastic surgery? Now, there is no ugly look. Not they labels and others unpleasant. Nice, others unpleasant. Certain forms of lips nice, others unpleasant. Certain colors of skin nice, others unpleasant. But society's values are not the same. Russia is now slowly picking up our values, but I come from a Slavic background. And Mama would have been it. They liked plump women. They were like the kind Rembrandt's. Those were the kind of women that were beautiful in Russia. And we were going very thin. They didn't want it at all. That was not beauty in Russia. Culture says what is beautiful or not. God intends you to know that you are beautiful, that you are precious physically, precious emotionally, precious intellectually. You have a mind, and it's supposed to think, and it's when it's thinking, it's supposed to make mistakes, but your mind is precious. You are precious socially, you are precious sexually, and you are precious spiritually. We live in a culture that I told you that has thoroughly put down the whole sexual area. These tapes helped me realize I was abused sexually by my mother. And she did it in the opposite way. I would never have dreamt it had I not listened to Pia. My mother just had her own hang-ups. And you have to pardon me for sharing this, but it's important to put it this way, and it's not wrong. Right after, I guess, I entered puberty, I came home one night. My mother interrupted a card game, took me upstairs, and I'd had a wet dream. And she pointed to the stain in the sheet, and she said, that is, with total hate, that is dirty, ugly, and sinful. Now that is sexual abuse. She made me feel dirty, ugly, and sinful for what God pronounced beautiful. God pronounced sex, which is part of man. He pronounced the whole universe good at the end of creation in the first book of Genesis. Anything good can be misused. That he doesn't want. But the drive itself is not ugly. It is not cheap. It is not titillating. It is beautiful and good. And God wants us to know that we are good this way. Now that's how God made us. That's what it means to be affirmed. Anything that strips someone from being precious in any of those areas is child abuse. And it leads then to the person being deprived of an experience of their goodness. You can be deprived, I can be deprived for a variety of reasons. You can be deprived because your parent dies and isn't there to pass it on. Because your mother is ill and isn't there to pass it on. I will teach you something that is absolutely astounding that may help you gently deal with other people. It's one of the more shocking truths I've learned. It's taught by Kubler-Ross as a parenthesis in a book of hers. Anything that happens in the life of a child before the child is 12 years old, the child takes full blame for. If, and this possibly applied to some of you, I'm going to walk delicately. If, I'll go because I'm the area that I know. If a girl's dad dies when she's 3 years old, he's killed in a war, killed in a mine accident, the child feels the blame. Now, you might think that's silly, but let me show you how obvious it is. What's the first lesson that a baby has to learn? The baby must learn, I caused the world. I'm hungry. If I just lie here, nothing's going to happen. If I cry, I get fed. I'm lonely. If I do nothing, nothing happens. If I giggle or cry, I get attention. If I do it on the potty, I get it rewarded. If I don't do it on the potty, I get punished. I cause what's happening in my world. All of a sudden, love is gone. Who's responsible for that? Me. What happens then in so many cases, these people who lose parents when they're children have a deep inner fear about ever loving because they're afraid if they ever fall in love, going back and playing a childhood tape, they will kill. This is where Freud would come in. They will kill the person they love. I taught a really neat kid in high school. And I watched this happen. Just really neat, solid. His mother had died when he was 8, 9, or 10 years old, maybe a little younger, 4 to 7, somewhere in there. He would have a tremendous crush on a gal until they became deep. And the second it became deep, not only sexual, until they both realized in teenage terms and with a certain maturity that they loved each other. And then instantly, within a week, it was over. And I tried gently, I didn't point out the cause, but I tried gently to show him he had a pattern. And he wasn't able to see it. A real fear. You can lose, you cannot feel blessed because something happens in childhood where your parents weren't able to give you the blessing. You cannot feel blessed because they gave it, but you weren't able to receive it. I don't know if my parents were able to give it. I can tell you an event that happened that kept me from getting it. And that is, almost immediately after birth, about within the first 6 months, I had for 50 some years ago rather major surgery. I know that from the distance they had to drive to do it. I had a blocked tear duct. And so I would be taken out of my home, subjected to pain in an atmosphere of a difference, and my mother's away. What do I feel? I feel unloved, like I'm not good enough. So something, the parents can give the love and the child doesn't receive it. Or the parents didn't get it themselves. And they're not able to pass it on. They want to. They try to. But you see, here's how you get the blessing. The first great lesson of life is caused by something they call bonding. And it's done between the child and the parent. The child has no feelings, and so he identifies, he bonds. She bonds with the parent, with the mother, with the father. There's a physical union. And if the parent, for whatever reason, hasn't had this sense of worth, they cannot at that moment give it to their children. Please now, please don't feel the guilt. Remember, go back to what I shared. God picked you to be the parent, and there's nothing that'll ever happen that he's not going to use for greater growth and glory. So this is not in any form to pass on guilt. I don't know. I would imagine maybe one out of a 10,000 blessed parents would not pass on the blessing. So if you didn't give it to your kids, it's because you didn't have it. And if you didn't have it, because you didn't get it. So there's no guilt running in here. We're talking about just something that happens. You can't give what you don't have. Now, let me again quickly show how Freud won't work at all. What's my problem? I don't feel blessed. Why don't I feel blessed? We can go to that silly instance I took because my mother left a wet diaper on. You go back and you show me that. What's changed? Nothing. I still don't feel blessed. Telling me why I didn't get the blessing does not give me the blessing. Deprivation is completely different from repression. Telling me I'm bearing anger and taking it out in other ways and letting me get the anger out makes my life better. Telling me I don't have a sense of worth does not make me feel better. As a matter of fact, going back, when I was in Edmond, Father Levin would be astounded. He'd come up to me and he would try to tell me how good I was, how good everything in my life was, and say, I can't understand why you feel a failure. You're such a success. And what he didn't understand was that made me feel worse, always. And it does with almost anybody I know like this. I felt worse. Because inside me, I was playing what I consider to be the most deadly song in the world. Oh, yeah. Yeah, y'all like my sermons. Yeah, y'all like, you know, this or that. But if you really knew. See, what's at the heart of codependency? When I didn't get the blessing, I feel flawed. And codependency is a shame-based existence. Guilt is what you feel for what you do. I, in my drinking, near the end of the drinking, hung up on suicidal people, and I still remember that. I carry, well, the guilts are gone now because I've worked it through, but I carry guilt for that, and it's a healthy thing. So guilt is a feeling of something I have done. Shame is a bad feeling for what I am. And that's a very different thing. Codependents are shame-based people as a result of not getting the blessing. About right at the time I sobered up, there was another, I give it in a lot of terms, I talked, you could call it deprivation. I'm not affirmed. I didn't get the blessing. I'm shame-based. There was another very simple term, even easier than any of the ones. The blessing is nice because it's from the Bible. And when you get into the positive, you know what people are supposed to get and how to do it. But other term that's kind of neat is, I'm okay. Inside you right now, how do you feel? Do you feel okay? And when you look at us, how do we look? Do we look okay? And see, my problem was, you all looked okay. You all looked okay, and I didn't feel okay. And the great tragedy about this is, a codependent will never make the comparison when they're feeling good. You know, they're at a football game, everything's going well, they're feeling okay. They'll never make the comparison when they might win. I only made the comparison when I wasn't feeling good. And like right now, if for some reason, because this talk can push a lot of your buttons, that's okay. It is okay to feel bad now. Please, let me tell you that. And it's okay. You have my permission, and codependents need this. You have my permission to enjoy yourself, and you have my permission, if your feelings are grunny, to feel miserable. It's okay, both feelings. And I forgot what I'm talking about. It's getting worse and worse. Anyhow, as a codependent, I feel not okay, and you look okay. Now, what follows from this? I must act right. I must act so that you will accept me. See, I'm not blessed. I'm not affirmed. I'm not okay. If I act right, you will tell me I'm okay, or I will tell me I'm okay. also, and this is how it's passed on, I will tailor myself to be who you want me to be. See, I don't have a sense of goodness. In order to stand up and be miserable, you have to feel that you have some inner goodness. When I first sobered up, I started working on the things that made me lousy, an SOB, first 3 years. The next 6 years, I started working on the defects, the vices that made me a nice guy. Some of my friends said I was very successful in that, you know, got rid of all of them. But see, I would be a doormat. I would let you walk on me. I would let you say anything. I would let you do anything. I would let you abuse me. I would let you use me 1,000 ways. And it seems, this can seem like good Christian masquerading. Codependents will make excellent martyrs. If you want a good description of a codependent is someone hanging on a cross in tremendous pain. And they're not nailed on. They can let go. This woman, the $4 million gal, she calls me about every 6 months. She'll call me with real pain about her husband. And I've told her this thing, and my phrase is, well, let go. I'm saying it to shake her, because she has enough sense of inner value, to shake her to see she is responsible for her pain. She's hanging onto that cross. I'm not telling her to divorce him. I'm telling her to claim enough inner value so she can not have her happiness depend upon what he says. She won't buy the garbage he's spewing out. She'll know she's okay because she is okay inside. She's not okay because he dumps garbage on her. She's okay because she feels it. She feels the presence of a loving God in her life. And that's how it kind of flows from the inner answer. But codependents will tailor themselves. They'll be people pleasers. This, incidentally, is why alcohol and drugs are as rampant as they are in American society. And why, if you'll pardon me, just saying no can't work. It can't work. With no sense of worth, and he says no, what does he have? He feels worse. His friends are. This is why peer pressure in the teen period is so tremendous. I don't know if you understand it, but most primitive cultures say you are a child until, and they have a ceremony for men and women. You are a child, you can run with children, you can be a child, you can act like a child, you go through that ceremony, from that day on, you've got to act like a child. And it's somewhere between 13 and 14. In America, since about 1900, we have been expanding the period of teenage, making when a person becomes an adult later and later and later, way into college time, so that what happens is you get teenagers, and let me show you now their real problem. They're not adult, and they're not children. You don't see them. You see them as adult and as children. They see themselves as adult and as children. The trouble is, you cross wires when you want to do it. They want to stay out until 4 o'clock in the morning when they're 12 years old, thinking they are fully grown up. You think that they're 2 years old, and you want them in at 6 o'clock at night. And so there's a clash here. Where they want to be adult, you see them most as child. Where they want to be child, they want to be able to be free to have a dirty room, not take any responsibilities around the house. That's where you want them to be most adult. And so they don't know who they are, and you don't know who they are in their relationship with you. And that's true with teachers, too. Teachers view them in this same way. What's the only group of people in the world who deal with them as they are, adult and childlike, and you can be both, and you can be either, wherever you are today, other teenagers, the same age. You take someone like that who has no standing in American society, don't know what they are, there's confusion and there's clash and there's fighting, and you give them an inner lack of worth, and they need approval. They desperately need approval. Saying is attacking the...